Thank you for this opportunity, and I wanted to specifically thank Dale. He has given me this chance this morning, and I'm very grateful for it. We're going to be talking about scenes in our stories today, and Dale entered my life in what was, without a doubt, the most tragic and horrible scene of my story to this point. So, among many other things, he's recognized something in me that he believes is a gift, and he's encouraged me in a number of ways to consider how it might be used. I feel strongly that without these people who are willing to push us, we can never fully live into the stories that in ways that God intends. So thank you, Dale. So last week, Dale introduced us to the storyline series that we'll be looking at together in the coming months. He told us some basic things about story and reminded us of some famous stories we all know from places like the Bible, Star Wars, and Harry Potter. He wanted us to walk away thinking about how God's story opens up subplots for each of us. Today, we'll think together about scenes in these subplots and explore what God might have us learn from fully experiencing these scenes. What I'd like to propose is the idea that the more difficult scenes in our lives are what allow us to enter into the stories of others. So, I believe that it's not the case that we as Christians are simply called to live out and pay attention to our own stories. When I think of my life as a story, or Dale's life as a story, or my sister-in-law Anne's life as a story, I think about these as they overlap and interact and are involved in and with the stories of others, including God's. And to me, the most important thing is that Anne, for example, is able to engage these stories of others in ways that God calls her. And I don't believe we can do this without embracing the demanding and inconvenient scenes that inevitably come up in our own lives. People who know me well know that I'm not much of a black and white person. Anything that draws strict lines around definitions or groups or concepts usually does not go over well with me. So, as I looked at the terminology presented in Donald Miller's storyline literature, I found myself cringing at the thought of categorizing the scenes of our lives into good and bad, or even positive and negative. I would like, instead, to revisit what has been a much more helpful paradigm for me that can be attributed to a biblical scholar named Walter Brueggemann. Dr. Brueggemann would say that we go, over and over again, from being oriented to being disoriented to eventually and hopefully being reoriented. So, I will speak today about our live scenes as being ones of orientation and disorientation, as opposed to good and bad, or happy and sad, or positive and negative. This, in and of itself, opens us up to many more possibilities and allows us to entertain the idea that something that is disorienting is not necessarily bad, or is not simply bad. It can be many things. We can think of orienting scenes in our lives as ones that set things up for us or position us. Again, they're not necessarily good, but they certainly can be. One's birth, for example, into a good family who has the resources to love and care for him or her is an orienting scene that happens to be a good one. On the other hand, a disorienting scene is one that pulls us away from this orientation. The loss of one of those parents, the loss of much of the family's money so that comfortable living becomes much more challenging, etc. And we can think of disorienting scenes in our lives as those that take us out of our comfort zone and force us to look at life in new ways. We can be disoriented by a number of things, from pressures to conform to society's demands on us to look, act, perform, or be a certain way, to times of loneliness, confusion, sadness, times when what worked before isn't working now, when we've been accustomed to thinking about, processing things, solving problems a certain way, and it's no longer doing the trick. And on the extreme end, we have tragedies like divorce, huge natural disasters, serious disease, and death. As is the case more often than we might like, our turning points often come in times of or as a result of trials in our lives. My story took its first tragic turn in the fall of 2009. Before the sudden death of my husband, I was much less inclined to stop and think about the stories of other people in ways that I am now. But once you've been on that other side, once you've genuinely experienced the capacity, once you have genuinely experienced the incapacity to smile back at the lady in the coffee shop and say, "I'm doing well, how are you?" Because all you want to say is, "Well, my husband just died, I'm left to raise 4 children on my own, I'm supposed to be living in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and I've somehow landed here in Highlands Ranch, Colorado. I just moved across the country away from my community of 6 years, and I'm living in my brother's basement trying to pick up the pieces. How do you think I am?" And then you look around and notice things you've never noticed before. You see someone crying, and you wonder about her pain. Is it like mine? Has she lost someone she loves? Will she be okay? Does she have people to help her? I'll never forget my daughter Lily saying that after the deaths of her dad and her brother, she'll never hear a siren the same way. She said, "All I can think about is how somebody's life is probably about to really change." She knows about being disoriented, and at 13, it's already affecting the way she's thinking of and might eventually enter into the life of another person. Experiencing disorienting scenes in our own lives allows us, among other things, to entertain the idea that stories of others may be pretty complicated too. It slows our reaction time, forces long pauses, encourages us to look around with new eyes, and probably most importantly, demands that we ask new questions or ask our old questions in new ways. When you encounter the rude, impatient, seemingly selfish jerk at the coffee shop, your old, perfectly oriented self might ask the question, "What's his story?" Whereas when you find yourself in a season of disorientation, or even if you've moved to one of reorientation, you learn to ask, "I wonder what his story might be." It's a very different question, and one that I think we're called to ask as faithful followers of Jesus. I find it quite appropriate that we're having this discussion in the middle of Lent, the season of reflection on the most disorienting scenes of Jesus' life. I was made aware a number of years ago of the tendency of many Christians to disregard Lent, and even more commonly, to downplay the events of Good Friday and direct all of their time, energy, and attention to Easter Sunday. This is surely a reflection of our level of discomfort around scenes of disorientation. We're trained as a culture to move away from uncomfortable things and move toward what we have defined as good, easy, inviting, etc. We don't typically like to talk about difficult things. We often have no idea how to handle pain and suffering, and we would often rather not be brought down by the more difficult things in our lives and or the lives of others. But we would do well to spend some time thinking about what Jesus' disorientation did for us. And when we engage in this exercise, we would do even better to stay there, in that place of disorientation, for much longer than what probably feels comfortable. The Saturday that comes between that Friday and that Sunday is huge, but few people pay attention to it. Sitting in the Saturdays, feeling them, agonizing over them, being taken in by them without Sunday in mind yet, that is true disorientation. Even in the spark of a thought that Sunday's coming, we've already begun to move toward reorientation. And if we rush too quickly to get there, we will surely miss out on much of what happens on Saturday. What happened on that Saturday was that Jesus was dead, gone. Yes, of course, there were promises of resurrection, but that doesn't really mean anything until it happens. So there, on that Saturday, the people who loved Jesus were heartbroken. They were crushed. They were agonizing. It was awful. But Jesus' acceptance of this scene in his life made it possible for him to enter into each of our stories that make all the difference to us as Christians. Romans 6:5 tells us that if we have been united with him in a death like his, we will certainly be united with him in a resurrection like his. To me, Paul calls us here to seriously consider what it looks like to be united with Christ in a death like his. Talk about disorienting. Christ's death came unfairly. He did not deserve to die. It came brutally. He was beaten, spit upon, and made fun of. And in the end, he had to face it all alone. Everyone except a few women left his side. And he felt forsaken, even by God, in the midst of the worst part of his story. So when Paul talks about being united in a death like Christ's, I think this call is one of repeated disorientation. And only after we begin to understand this can we begin to understand what it will be like to be united with him in a resurrection like his. I was excited last week when Dale turned our attention to Harry Potter, a personal family favorite. Anyone familiar with this story knows that Harry was orphaned as a baby when the antagonist Voldemort killed his mother and father. It's a horrible scene, one where you want to sink down in your seat, hide your face in the shoulder of the person next to you, maybe look up for a minute only to see it's not over yet, it's still really bad. You may squint for a few seconds, feeling like maybe you could take it in that way, but it's still too awful. This part of Harry's story is hard and horrible and tragic. We as his friends and his fans and those who love him would do anything to change it for him. We want Harry to be loved and cared for by his parents. We want them to be there when Harry emerges victorious at the end, overcoming even death to save those whom he loves. The problem is, without this scene, he wouldn't be the same Harry. This event in his life is a huge part of what makes Harry Potter, Harry Potter. He has to be Harry the orphan, who was raised by the horrible Dursleys and overcame one obstacle after another to emerge as the hero of the story. Now, please know that I'm not making an argument here that you have to go through these kinds of challenges to emerge as a hero. I'm simply pointing out that the way Harry responded to the many disorienting scenes in his life gave him opportunities to enter into the stories of Ron and Hermione and Ginny and Hagrid. That's how, on my better days, I try to think of my story. No one who loves me wants my story to read the way it does. The list of people who would line up to delete my scenes of tragically losing my son, and then 3 years later, I'm sorry, tragically losing my husband, and then 3 years later, my firstborn son, is a long one. And I personally believe that Jesus is at the front of that line. However, I think a critical part of my life as a subplot of God's story is my recognition that something new can emerge from these disruptive, disorienting scenes. My story does not end with them. In saying this, let me make it clear that I think some of the worst pastoral care happens when, as I mentioned earlier, this process is rushed along or spoken of by a person who has never walked in the shoes of the one whom he or she is counseling. We have to be slow, and we have to be careful. So, to quote Romans 8:28 about all things working together for good to a person in the midst of a disorienting scene of his or her life is not only unhelpful, it's harmful. To sit down next to her and love her and care for her until the next scene emerges is to pay attention to God's call in your own story, your call to love and compassion for your brothers and sisters in need. This in and of itself may be disorienting to you, but so goes the cycle of one's disorientation allowing for yet another opportunity to be woven into the story of another. And the way you move through disorienting scenes will determine what might be the beginning of the next scene in your story or in that of another. What do you want it to look like? And more importantly, if you're a person of faith, what does God want it to look like? Dale encouraged me to think about a practical way that we could live out some of these things. And I was thinking about other disorienting things in the Bible. And my brother recently reminded me of the scenes of the children coming to Jesus. And I started thinking about how disorienting and disruptive this was for the disciples and the whole scene. And, you know, they were bothered and annoyed and disrupted. But Jesus, of course, once again welcomes these little ones. And he went on to tell us that the kingdom of heaven belongs to them. As a community of people trying to live into God's call for us, I thought it would be neat to spend some time praying for our children, specifically about our call to teaching them about disorientation. My dad has shared with me on more than one occasion that he really wishes he was told as a child that life is hard. To simply be made aware that it's going to be rough, if not a lot of the time, at least some of it. So as a body and as a group, as a community, I thought, let's make sure our children know that they will be disoriented. Things will come along in their lives that they won't like, they won't understand, and they won't know what to do with. But we as parents, we as a community, we as a faithful people of God will be there for them through all the scenes in their lives so they can face them, knowing that we can, in time, move through these scenes together into the next one, whatever it may be. And I just was looking at the pictures earlier that the kids had drawn and thinking about, you know, where they are when they come up with these things. And it's kind of a neat exercise. I thought it would be neat just to spend some time standing there, you know, praying for each child who has, or pick, you know, pick one child and pray for that child and their movement toward and through the scenes in their lives. So thank you very much.